Diverse authorities have speculated. Why is it that the common mass of people so adore the rotten, the awful, the trite? In a remote laboratory, two genuine warlocks, Ben R. Williams and Greg Morrison, will look popular taste dead in the eye and hold a scalpel to its bloated gullet. They will read America's most popular books. They will ridicule the New York Times bestseller list. They will destroy their reputations and follow a terrible book even into a rotting grave. This, good people, is cannon fodder.
I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer. I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ben R. Williams.
And I'm Greg Morrison.
And welcome to episode 11 of Cannon Fodder.
Yeah, we got. Well, first of all, Ben, I feel like I should apologize to our listeners.
Why is that, Greg?
It's weird. So last week I announced that we would be reading Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. In fact, the book we read is not a work of juvenilia, an early film by Martin Scorsese. Sort of a precursor to Mean Streets, but in fact, a book called Go Ask Alice.
Okay.
So I'd like to reestablish that we did not read Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which is also cool, but we read Go Ask Alice. And you know, I would like to say, man, the back cover of my book says you can't ask Alice anything anymore. And that includes two words in the title that I mistook it for, and it also has an appealing picture of the diarist underneath, looking sort of like a cross between Lana Del Rey and Carrie Fisher, young Carrie Fisher. So, you know, I was entranced. I'm sorry. I failed everyone. I'm sorry.
It's a very easy mistake to make. I think that the people knew what you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And I'm sure that all seven listeners, hey guys.
Hey guys.
I'm sure they knew what you were talking about.
Yeah, well, they probably looked up on Wikipedia and were like, oh, that fucking asshole.
Well, I didn't catch it either, so, you know, we share the blame on this one. But we did read Go Ask Alice by Anonymous, sort of.
Mm.
Before we get into that, you read any good books lately, Greg?
Nah. I mean, I've been reading a few things. I've been reading some early Virginia history, some stuff about the Greeks, Roberto Colasso. He's one of my favorite authors. I'd highly recommend him. Some Nietzsche. And
so no, Roberto Colasso is my wrestling name. I don't know. The giant Italian, Roberto Colasso.
And I'm currently reading a pretty cool book by a local author, Mr. Martin Clark. His honor. Mm-hmm. You know, just a little plug because, you know, we'd love to have him.
We're going to try to get him. He's working on a new book, I understand. Oh, and, okay. Yeah, the judge, he's always got an iron in the fire.
That's true.
And, yeah, trying to maybe get him on a future podcast. By trying, I mean it's a thought that's crossed my mind. I haven't asked him yet.
2 months ago.
But, I'm sure he'd be up for it for all the publicity, you know, he'd get from it. I mean, he's probably going to move like 4 or 5 books he comes on here. You know?
Maybe. That's, maybe.
Man could go buy him a moon pie after that.
Well, what about you? What have you been reading?
I haven't been reading a whole lot lately. I've been very busy. I did start reading a birthday present book given to me by one Mr. Greg Morrison.
Oh, really?
About some Scrimshaw.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I've been reading this the Scrimshaw book.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A great gift.
Oh.
So, yeah, I thank you for that. I'm enjoying it. I'm not very far yet, but I'm enjoying it.
It's a very intimate moment, ladies and gentlemen, that you're witnessing right now. So this is the softer side of Cannon Fodder. we give each other presents.
Yeah. It's, you know, Cannon Fodder is all about people bonding over Scrimshaw, I think. And that was part of the original mission.
Yeah.
So,
well, I guess we ought to summarize this thing.
Well, first off, what were your expectations going into this book?
Well, you know, I actually had read parts of it when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. The copy that I read is kind of a beat to shit copy from the early 70s. I have a printing from 71 or 72.
Oh, wow.
I think that my father got it for largely ironic reasons, so that he and his hip friends could sit around and laugh at it. I don't know that for sure. It could have been my mom's. But I read it when I was a kid, and I was just sort of befuddled by it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really remember it at all. And I'm thinking that probably I stopped reading it before it got weird, mm-hmm. because it's really boring at the beginning.
Yes.
But I pretty much expected it to be overwrought, and it would have, like, one drug experience, and then everything was bad after that.
Yeah.
Which didn't really pan out. But what about you? What, did you have any expectations?
All I knew about it going in was that when we were in middle school, we had a shared teacher.
Yeah, many.
Many. There was one in particular who taught us English who had this book on our middle school reading list. And I remember her talking about it at great length and really encouraging us to read it. Because, yeah, guys, this is a true story of what could and probably will happen to you. Because that was sort of her teaching style, yeah. was to conjure up just terrible things and, you know, just inform us, like, well, when you go to college, 115% of you will be horribly raped. Yeah. Men and women alike.
The college terror alert is presently at red. She tried to inspire by fear, basically. Yeah. That was her plan.
Yeah, but she she considered this book to be gospel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
This was... I think that her understanding of the drug world was probably largely formed by Go Ask Alice, which is just hilarious. Yeah. So that was really all I knew going into it was, you know, here's a true story of of drug use.
Yeah, yeah. Representative story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the only thing I knew going into it was a huge lie. That yeah. was...
Well, that's fitting. but so the book purports to be a diary by a girl who turns 15 during the course of it. Mm-hmm. And... by the end of it, I guess she's no more than, like, 17, probably, right?
Well, that's... yeah, I guess she's over 16, maybe 17. I know that there are a couple of weird things, because she turns 15, like, September 20th. And then later on in the book, on, like, August 15th, she says, I just turned 15, so yeah. I don't... so
yeah, so, I mean, either she's really high, you know... there's some serious chronology issues, which tends to undermine the credibility of the manuscript. But there were rumors... well, basically, anyway, it's a teenage girl, and she has, like, initial drug experiences. And I think, actually, her first drug experience is LSD. And then she scales down. and I think marijuana is actually her last drug, which would sort of... or one of her last drugs, which would sort of tend to undermine the whole gateway drug thing. But yeah, basically she just goes on this drug-fueled odyssey. She runs away from home at one point with one of her friends to San Francisco, Den of Iniquity. Mm-hmm. She ends up on the street prostituting herself, it seems, and hitchhiking and basically being a beggar and a transient. At various times, she is reclaimed by her family, her mother, her father, her sister, Alexandria, her brother, Tim, mm-hmm. and Graham and Gran, mm-hmm. her two grandparents, who cack out partway through. Well, first Graham dies, and then, well, Dad dies, and then Mom dies. But anyway, yeah, so then she's confined to a mental institution because angry druggies are mad at her because she's straight now. And their vengeance is to surreptitiously dose her with LSD, which, of course, makes her go completely insane.
Yeah.
So they put her in a mental institution, and, you know, she's writing to the diary. And little known fact, Ben, this book is actually not a drug warning book. The purpose of the book actually became clear to me on the last page of the book.
Oh, yeah?
The subject of this book died 3 weeks after her decision not to keep another diary. It's actually advocating teenagers have a safe place to record their thoughts, because otherwise, without a diary, I mean, you just cack out. It's a pretty obvious correlation. But yeah, anyway, she dies at the end, off screen, as it were. And It's meant to be kind of a classic tragedy structure, that she goes from an idyllic and innocent life to a corrupted life to believing that maybe she could be redeemed to failing again and, despite her best wishes, dying.
Yeah, it is that. I guess one of the first things we've got to get into is that this book, though it is... The cover of your copy, in fact, Greg, says, A Real Diary. Yeah. It says that right before the title of it.
Yeah.
And this book is has been sold for many, many years as being an actual diary of this 15-year-old girl. But it's not. That becomes obvious just reading it. But additionally, if you do a little bit of research, you discover that it was written... at least in part, and probably wholly fabricated, by a woman named Beatrice Sparks.
Yeah.
Who was a Mormon sort of psychologist. There's some dispute as to whether or not she actually had a degree in psychology. And Beatrice Sparks, she actually passed away this past May at the age of 95, probably due to a drug overdose. It hits us all, man. At
some well, she'd
point.
Been turning tricks for so long by that point, it was bound to catch up with her.
Yeah.
Sorry, family of Beatrice Sparks.
Well, and one of the things that about her that sheds some discredit onto this book is that all she wrote were books like this.
Mm.
She wrote like 10 books. That were sort of in this vein, you know, true diaries of kids who got into something weird. And there's like one that's about a teenage prostitute and, you know, and all this. But the most famous one next to Go Ask Alice is called Jay's Journal, which is allegedly like there was a real Jay and he actually did die of a drug overdose or something. And she sort of used some of his journal entries, except... she added in this whole thing where he joins a cult to worship Satan. And this came out, like, I think in the 80s when all the, you know, well, the satanic cults are going to come and steal away your child.
Right.
Which never happened. No. Like, it was this huge hysteria that swept the nation that never had a single piece of corroborating evidence. So that's the sort of thing she was writing. So when you read this book, even... aside from the fact that it seems eminently reasonable that it was written by a Mormon woman in her 50s, it becomes pretty clear that, you know, maybe this isn't factually accurate at all.
Well, I will say there were quite a few points where you would not only think that it was not written by a teenager, which we can get back around to, but in particular written by a religious person, because every drug trip involves a religious vision, basically. So, for instance, in the LSD trip... soon whole trains of thought started to appear between each word. I had found the perfect and true and original language used by Adam and Eve, but when I tried to explain, the words I used had little to do with my thinking. I was losing it. It was slipping out of my grasp. This wonderful and priceless and true thing which must be saved for posterity. I felt terrible, and finally I couldn't talk at all and slumped back onto the floor, closed my eyes, and the music began to absorb me physically. Now, it goes on at some length, and it says that my mind was possessed, or my mind possessed the wisdom of the ages, and there are no words adequate to describe them and all that sort of stuff. But the fact that she alludes to the Adamic language, you know, the primeval tongue with which Adam named all the animals in the garden, you know, before the Tower of Babel when all humanity spoke the holy tongue, that's a pretty arcane thing.
Yeah.
And most teenagers don't know about that. And I mean, it's kind of a stretch to think that, like, you know, in the midst of some sort of euphoric, sensuous experience, she would immediately think, you know, oh, I found the Philosopher's Stone.
There are a lot of instances, too, where she seems to have a level of self-understanding that no one at the age of 15 would have.
No.
And certainly no one in this set of circumstances. For example, this is very early in the book, before she even starts doing drugs, she's talking about fitting in at school. She says, sometimes I think we're all trying to be shadows of each other, trying to buy the same records and everything, even if we don't like them. Kids are like robots off an assembly line, and I don't want to be a robot.
Nope.
It's only a few steps removed from, and I wish they'd get off my damn lawn.
You yeah, know what I mean? Pretty much.
It's like the stuff that crotchety old people say. Yeah. Oh, this generation, you know, just buy them records.
Yeah.
And she, there are times when she's argumentative with her mother, but then she'll have this moment of, you know, well, I guess my mother, you know, she has her reasons, and,
yeah.
you know, maybe I'm the one who has a problem. Like, no 15-year-old no. girl thinks that. Yeah, mom's a bitch. I mean, that's pretty much where it starts and where it ends.
Well, that's the problem is that, you know, like, the robot thing. Like, yeah, I mean, teenagers are not completely unselfconscious the way that they consume things. They never have been. I mean, they're learning about the world, too. But the thing that is frustrating about that in particular is that usually teenagers, you know, when they look at people and they're like, oh, everybody's just trying to fit in, they immediately think, but not me.
Yeah.
I listen to cool records. Everybody else only listens to records because, you know, they want to fit in. Whereas my records, well, they make me seem different. There is a kind of like tribal clinging in teenagers that she never really gets right. She spends a lot of time talking about clothes. She claims that she washes her hair in mayonnaise, which sounds disgusting. I hope no one does that.
That is a thing.
That's a thing?
Yeah. I can't remember why you do it. I dated a girl who used to do that for some reason.
Tisk, tisk. No good, man.
It was just because she knew how much I loved mayonnaise. And she
slurped.
Oh, baby. Bring that on over.
Got that beaten egg smell to you. But yeah, there's a lot of things like that, and she the main thing that usually gives away a writer who's faking it is that a character notices things that she will not, or he will not. Mm-hmm. So for instance, she rather carefully enumerates the shape and tally of her eating disorders. So she'll talk about, like, various caloric counts and things like that, and, you know, like, nothing's wrong with me. And mom keeps telling me that I'll actually have to eat at dinner. But it, none of it rings true in the sense of like a found document. It reads sort of like a novelistic construction that is an unhappy dance between, you know, like dialogue, like a character being unreflective and just saying things out loud, and a narrator commenting on the action. It sort of bounces between the two. And all pretending to be in this person's voice.
Particularly when the food in question she doesn't want to eat is French fried potatoes.
Yes.
Which is how all the kids refer to them.
Yes. Seven glorious, heavenly French fried potatoes. But yeah, the thing I was going to mention, and I don't know what you thought about this. I thought a lot about the structure of the book. So the book is basically supposed to be a tragedy.
Yes.
But the thing about a tragedy is that it has to convince you on some level that they're falling from something. What did you think about the family?
I didn't think about them at all, really. Yeah. No one in this book exists as a character. I reached a point very quickly where I stopped even trying to keep track of who was who.
Yeah.
And part of that is that there are a lot of characters that enter the book for a very brief period and then just disappear.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where you wonder why they're even included.
Yeah.
She has this endless assortment of friends who drift into her life, just, you know, hello, I exist, then off they go, never to be seen again.
Well, they're drug delivery packages, basically.
Yeah. But yeah, the parents are not well defined at all. Well, I mean, her siblings are not defined at all. I know nothing about
them. Yeah.
In fact, Alex, I think it was halfway through the book before I realized Alex was a girl. That was her little sister, you know, Alexandria. The parents are supportive, generally, and sometimes they're not. That's about it.
Yeah. I mean, her father's like the president of a university, right?
He does something at a university. I don't know.
He's getting a new job at the beginning of the book and they're moving. And this is the only glimpse, the only time that I thought that the parents actually, there's a suggestion of an independent life that she was witnessing but could not understand. So they're moving, right? Mom has either the stomach flu or she's just upset because of the excitement of moving. Anyway, Dad has had to stop twice so that she could throw up. Yeah, that's really promising. You know, you're moving your family to a new hometown. Pull over, I have to throw up. Otherwise, Alice describes, or, well, she's actually not Alice. She's just, she meets Alice, but she is not named Alice.
I think, to make it easier to discuss, we should probably refer to her as Alice.
All right.
Because she doesn't, she's not given a name.
Funky Alice. She describes herself as cloddy and misfitting. Mm-hmm. And her brother, Tim, treats her like a dum-dum, which is the worst of all fates.
Oh, no.
But, yeah, so, like, the idea is that she's going to have, like, this innocent life. But it never really seems charming enough or entrancing enough to warrant, like, any sort of, you know, like, oh, man, she's really got it good, and she doesn't even know how good she has it. But then begins her incessant fall. And this is the most fun to talk about.
Oh, yeah. This is... All the drug stuff in the book is hilarious. This is the best unsung comedy novel of 1971, folks. It's really fucking funny.
It is. It's really funny.
So, she initially gets into drugs. I mean, everything leading up to her dabbling in drugs, there is no indication that she has the type of personality. I mean, maybe the eating disorder thing to a certain extent, but for the most part, there's no explanation for why she would do this.
Right.
She goes to a party, and the kids at this party play Button, Button, Where's the Button?
Mm-hmm.
And they play this game that I'm not familiar with at all.
You didn't play that?
I never did. No. I was too busy playing Hoopstick.
Yeah, exactly. But,
what they do is everybody gets a can of Coke. And there are 14 people there, and 10 of the cans of Coke are dosed with LSD. And old Alice, we'll call her, she's one of the lucky winners who gets the LSD Coke, and proceeds to go nuts. But she has a great trip, you know. She's inexplicably, she's has a really nice time, and you know, becomes a child of the universe and all that shit. And her response to this happening is not, holy shit, what's wrong with these people?
Yeah.
Why would they do something like this? That was terrifying. It's, you know, I gotta look more into this whole drug thing. Maybe I'll go to the library at the university and get a book on the drugs. That's her takeaway.
Yeah.
Now, here's the crazy thing. All right, let me find the page. So... she does LSD, right? And she says, well, you know, that was really good. Maybe I'll try that marijuana I've been hearing so much about. Okay, so she says on my book, it's page 26, she talks about how, you know, she thought about doing pot, but she's decided, quote, the whole experience is over and past, and I'll never think of it again. 2 pages later, page 28, on a date. The speed was a little scary at first because Bill had to inject it right into my arm. I remembered how much I hated shots when I was in the hospital, but this is different. Now I can't wait. I positively can't wait to try it again. No wonder it's called speed. All right. I know some people who do drugs.
Yeah.
I do not know anyone who would ever say, you know, just sort of dabbling in the world of drugs. You know, I think I'm just going to skip straight ahead to intravenous drug use. Yeah. I think that's where I'm heading. That's like later stages. Like, I'm either an enormous celebrity in 1982, or I've done like 7 blowjobs this week. Now it's time for heroin, you know.
Yeah.
You don't just skip to that. And also, I'm not familiar with doing speed intravenously, but maybe that was a thing in the 70s.
Yeah, I don't know how the metabolic process works if you have to ingest it, and that's how it goes in your bloodstream. I don't know. I don't even know where you get liquid speed.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. I don't really know where you get pill speed either, for that matter. But
bikers?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I like the thing, like the consequence of her speed. I've washed my hair and cleaned my room and done all the things Mom has been nagging me to do for days. The only problem is it's night and I can't seem to turn the energy off.
Well, that is the downside of speed.
Yeah. But basically, this pretty much is like, okay, so you know the movie The Jerk?
Yes.
If Steve Martin was a 15-year-old girl versus drugs... There's, like, in particular, there is this one quote. I'm afraid to live and afraid to die. Just like the old Negro spiritual.
Yes.
New sentence. I wonder what their hang-up was. It's full of stuff like that. Like, it's just, it's this nincompoop. Mm-hmm. Just sort of wandering through the world. But it's not a believable nincompoop.
No.
A believable naive girl who is as goody two-shoes as she was and trying to fit in would be horrified by the LSD experience she had.
Yes.
She would never speak to those people again. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, she would not sit in a parked car and tie off her arm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, and you know what she does shortly after that? 3 pages after the intravenous drug use. Well, last night it happened. I am no longer a virgin. Mm-hmm. In a way, I'm really sorry, because I always wanted Roger to be the first and only boy in my life, but he's away visiting. In fact, I haven't seen him since I got here. He might have grown into a gawky, stupid, rambling idiot anyhow. Unlike me.
Yeah, really.
It escalates so quickly.
Yeah.
That, I mean, my jaw dropped. Because you figured, yeah, I went into this expecting there to be sort of the natural cautionary tale progression where, no. She smokes a joint, and maybe she gets to like marijuana, and then, you know, and it right. continues. No, this is like, you know, redlining it right off the yeah. line, man. I mean, this is...
Well, and that's the other thing, is that she never really has a bad drug experience. She has bad people experiences, mm-hmm. but she never has a bad drug experience. She's never on LSD and, like, you know, a demon carves out her heart and makes her eat it. Like, nothing like that happens.
Yeah.
It's always like, yeah, you know, I saw God or whatever, and, you know, I kissed Jesus' wounds and they miraculously healed, and it was revealed that I was, in fact, God. Like, it wasn't like that. You know, it's always that kind of beautiful moment, mm-hmm. no matter what's happening to her.
Yeah, well, she talks quite a bit about, you know, this is the greatest moment I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
You know, doing this drug was the greatest thing ever. And then later on, after one of the times when she quits doing drugs, she talks about picking up this little kitten, and it starts nursing on her earlobe. She's like, well, this is better than all the drugs in the world. Really? I'm not convinced.
Well, isn't the kitten named Happiness, too?
Yeah, the kitten's named Happiness. Yeah.
It has this sort of, like, medieval mystery play quality. Just, like, all these allegorical figures enter in, you know, like, yeah. And then Satan came.
Yeah.
And then the beautiful innocence came by and kissed me.
Yeah.
But one thing we should talk about is the inevitable consequence of doing drugs. I mean, as we all know, is that you become a dealer.
Yes.
And so since Alice is a high schooler, you know, she's got a ready market. Lots of kids with disposable income. And it turns out that a lot of kids have more money than you'd think. Isn't that right, Ben?
It's true. You know, today I went to the grade school again. I don't mind pushing at high school because the stuff is sometimes kind of hard to get, and the kids usually come up and ask me for it. Chris and I just supply it from Richie. Richie, by the way, since is later described as a low-class queer.
Yes.
We'll get back to that. He can get whatever is their bag, barbs or pot or amphetamines or LSD or DMT or meth or anything. The high school kids are one thing, and even the junior high. Today I sold 10 stamps of LSD to a little kid at the grade school who was not even 9 years old, I'm sure. I know that he in turn must be pushing, and these kids are just too young. The thought of 9 and 10-year-olds getting wasted is so repulsive that I'm not going over there anymore. I know if they want it, they'll get it somewhere, but they won't get it from me. Who?
Well, not only like, well, I guess I have to go to the grade school to sell LSD.
Yeah.
But furthermore, who concludes from this bizarre alternate universe of, you know, like, well, I sold it to a 9-year-old, immediately assumes, well, you know that 9-year-old's a pusher.
Yeah.
You know, like, that 9-year-old's bad news.
I said, goddamn. I mean, it's so crazy. Because, like, I remember when I was a kid hearing stories, probably from the same teacher who recommended this book to me, about, well, you know, you've got to be careful, you know, because I've heard these stories that they're giving, like, tabs of LSD to little kids and telling them, you know, it's candy or It's like a stamp and you lick it and the kids are going on trips. It's like, okay, well, that's preposterous. For one thing, that's never happened. But that's not even as crazy as 9-year-olds coming up like, yeah, I'm looking to buy some LSD. Like,
yeah, hey, are you holding?
Yeah. I got to sell it to Timmy, you know, by the swing set. He's jonesing pretty bad for that addictive old LSD. I mean, it's so crazy that it can't not be funny. I mean, it's so outside the realm of possibility.
Well, there's several things like that. So I'll mention perhaps one of the more outlandish examples. So after a while, her like dating of her entries falls off, and she's not very good at dating things anymore. And the top of it just has a question mark. And so this one goes, question mark. I don't know what or when or where or who it is. I only know that I'm now a priestess of Satan. A priestess of Satan, trying to maintain after a freakout to test how free everybody was and to take our vows. That's it. That's the whole journal entry. I only know now that I'm a priestess of Satan. And it never really comes up again.
No, it never comes
like
up.
Like the fact that she joins the Church of Satan. Yeah. It's just, oh, well, you know.
Yeah. We've all had that weekend. Well, the transformation that she has is so fucking funny. Because at the beginning of this book, yeah, you've got this girl who's talking about, you know, going on dates and maybe letting boys hold her hand. And, you know, she makes her own clothes because it's the 70s and you did that then, you know, and it was more common. And, you know, just talking about how she loves the new house and, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then, a mere 84 pages into the book, allow me to read you a question marked entry, which is, for my money, the greatest part of the entire book. Another day, another blowjob. The fuzz is clamped down till the town is mother dry. If I don't give Big Ass a blow, he'll cut off my supply. Hell, I'm shaking on the inside more than I'm shaking on the outside. What a bastard world without drugs. The dirty Ofay who wants me to lay it on him knows my ass is dragging, but he's doling out the only supply I know about. I'm almost ready to take on the fat cats, the rich Philistines, or even the whole public for one good shot. Goddamn Big Ass makes me do it before he gives me the load. Everybody's just lying around here like they're dead, and little Jacon is yelling, Mama, Daddy can't come now. He's humping Carla. I've got to get out of this shithole. Yes, I speak jive.
Yeah, it was so insane. I should state, for the record, that I read this book in the Collinsville, Virginia Hardee's, and I'm surrounded by these old people, and then you read something like that, where she's casually referring to this person called Big Ass,
yeah,
who apparently she just has to blow constantly.
Well, the town's mother dry, Greg. I mean, what are you going to do?
Where else are you going to get a load dropped on you?
Yeah.
And then this mysterious Jacon or Jacon,
mm-hmm,
who never appears again.
No.
Or what? Who's banging Carla? Or I don't know. It's just...
Cheers was a spinoff of Go Ahead Scouts.
Banging Carla.
What the whole book reminds me of, the whole book is written in the style. You know that scene in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas? The guy, the drug expert at the DA conference, yeah, talking about, like, well, you know, the addict wears T-shades to conceal his roomy eyes.
Yeah.
His pants are stained with semen from his constant raping. Yeah. It's like that. It's so out of touch and so bizarre.
Knuckles white from inattention.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it actually, that was something I was going to say. It kind of reminded me of Hogg at certain points where, yeah, which, by the way, folks, bonus episode, Hogg. Go back and read it or listen to it. Mainly about cows, though. But anyway, yeah, I mean, that sort of weird, the way that, like, the journal entries would just come out of nowhere, mm-hmm, almost like you were in some sort of apartment building, and, like, a door flew open, and, you know, you see, like, a horrible slum where, like, somebody's just having sex on the floor and simultaneously shooting up, and, like, the door mysteriously slams shut, and you never know what happens again. Yeah. It had that kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, horror dropping in out of nowhere. I can't remember the context, but speaking of taking on the Philistines, mm-hmm, probably the only, like, really good line for the novel.
Oh, yes.
She's yelling at, like, passersby, I think in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And when people give her change, she and her friends yell out, "Mighty kind of y'all. I hope you have a nice orgasm with your dog tonight."
That's a good line.
Yeah, it's a good line.
And I mean, but you just imagine that was written by, you know, just some hunched over Mormon woman. Just, what's the worst thing you could say to somebody? Well, Beatrice, you're not going to enjoy typing this, but I guess you'd better.
Yeah.
The kid's got to know.
What I also liked, you know, so we talked about how, like, all of her drug experiences are good, but terrible things happen to her usually when she does the drugs.
Yep.
And the thing is that there's usually no setup for it. So anyway, Shelia, who's a giant, beautiful woman, and Richie, who is apparently just this insufferable homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, like, gay hating in this book that is very pre, like, Stonewall, pre, you know, hey, don't be mean to gay people just because they're gay.
Well, it's very much, based on this book, the idea seems to be that the only reason anyone is gay is because they did a lot of drugs and were sexually abused.
Well, she starts becoming more and more interested in women the more drugs she does. And she starts having, like, a frantic, almost, like, arm-scratching desire to have sex with a girl.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like, oh, well, it's only the drugs talking.
Well, I mean, this is all accurate, right?
So she's just about to go into a heroin trip, which, you know, I mean, I don't know heroin very well. Well, at all. I don't know why I said very well. But, I mean, like, I have no experience of heroin, so I don't know if, like, you hallucinate and shit. But, anyway. So she's just about to go under heroin. She's like, you know, but just before I was too out of it to notice what was going on, I saw Shelia and that cocksucker, Richie, she goes with, lighting up and setting out speed. I remember wondering why they were getting high when they had just set us out on this wonderful low. And it wasn't until later I realized that the dirty sons of bitches had taken turns raping us and treating us sadistically and brutally. Now, well, that had been their planned strategy all along. The low-class shit-eaters. Now, okay. You know, if you were just to read, like, yeah, they took turns raping us and it was this awful, horrible thing. I mean, there's probably not a way that someone would confide that without it sounding sudden and brutal. The giveaway is not they took turns raping us. The giveaway is took turns treating us brutally and sadistically. When you say that, like, A, teenagers usually don't talk like that.
Yeah.
And B, it's not the way that people refer to that experience.
No.
It just has this quality of remove that she never really can expunge from her writing.
Yeah. It's like, well, you get the impression, like, well, I mean, I don't know what they did, but, you know, I mean, they probably would do something horrible, right? I mean, that's what these people do, so.
Mm.
Treated us brutally and sadistically.
It was bad, real bad.
There were big old demons.
Well, I kind of got the feeling, though, you know, like all the religious stuff, like she says that, you know, like the first time that she does pot, everyone in the whole universe was mad except me. I was the only sane and perfect being. Somewhere in my brain I remembered reading that 1,000 years with man is as a day with the Lord, and I had found the answer. I was even now in my new time length, living the lives of 1,000 men in the space of hours. I mean, that's a pretty bizarre description of what I've seen potheads do when under.
Yeah.
Usually they just like Adult Swim and Cheetos and ketchup off and on.
Possessed.
Yeah. But, you know, it seems like she's saying that, you know, drugs are just this sort of false god. I mean, that seems to be her implicit thing. I mean, it's not very well disguised. I don't need to belabor the point. But it's not quite as much of a crypto-evangelizing thing as I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
But there are definite undercurrents of, like, you know, well, if she had been going to youth group, she probably wouldn't have been raped by that strange couple in San Francisco.
Probably. We can't
well,
be certain.
Yeah, no one can be certain.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I really enjoyed, and you know, she runs away a couple of times, and there's never any clear motivation for why she runs away. But she shows up at home and talks about how great everything is, and you know, suddenly she's doing drugs again. I guess that's, maybe that's somewhat realistic, actually. Maybe that is, you know, sometimes how relapses work. But here's what's not realistic. One of the last times when she tries to get clean, the Grass Gang comes after her. Now, the Grass Gang are all the kids at her high school who, like, initially got her into the drugs, I suppose. And they love that marijuana.
Well, they know she was a pusher.
Yeah, they know all about her and, you know, her past. And they see that she's trying to get clean. Those bunch of potheads ain't going to stand for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, just like a pothead would do, they hatch a Byzantine plan and execute it to destroy her life. Now, it's not clear why they do this. Yeah. I guess they just, you know, want company. They're missing the fifth member. I don't know. But they do stuff, you know, those rat finks had a joint in her purse.
Yeah.
They threaten to drug her little sister. They, like, drive by her house honking the horn. And ultimately, in the big climax, I guess, they as much as this book could be said to have a climax, she's babysitting. And they have somehow sneaked into the house where she's babysitting LSD-laced chocolate-covered peanuts.
Yeah.
And she eats some and goes on a bad trip. And I will confess, I was so disappointed that she didn't eat the baby. Because I really thought that was where that was going. You know, the couple would come home and, you know, oh, that roast in the oven smells delicious, but why are you cradling the roast? Oh, God! I was hoping for that scene, you know, but that didn't happen. The baby was fine. But anyway, they end up getting her committed to this institution. And the question is why? You know, why? I've never... I think this book operates on this fallacy.
Hmm.
That I remember very vividly from when I was coming of age.
Hmm.
I remember this commercial in the early 90s where, you might remember this one, Greg. Is this kid, he's like maybe 10 years old, and he's at school, and the bully comes up to his locker. He's got like a fistful of joints.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, smoke one, smoke a joint. What are you, chicken? Aren't you going to smoke a joint? Which the kid replies, I'm not a chicken, you're a turkey. And everyone laughs hysterically at the bully, and, you know, he goes and kills himself in shame or something. At that time, being called a turkey was the worst insult.
It was horrible in the early 90s. Didn't want it.
It was terrible. The Harlem Globetrotters had taught us all a thing or two about calling people turkeys. But, you know, the message of that commercial was, when you're in school, people are going to try to push drugs on you angrily.
Yeah.
Something that's never happened.
No.
My experience with, you know, again, knowing the artistic types, it's usually pretty bashful and sheepish about even bringing that up.
Yeah.
And you will never hear, like, oh, come on, don't you want a joint, you fucking pussy? You'll never hear that.
Hey, you big homo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's never like that. And I mean, you know, I mean, it's not just like, you don't have to know anyone who's even nominally creative. You can know people who, you know, swear they're going to write that song one day.
Yeah.
You know, you went to college. I mean, you know, people in general, I think maybe because of the war on drugs, I don't know. You know, people are very, very frightened. And usually it's like, hey, you know, you don't have to. It's like, not a big deal. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, whatever, man. It's cool. It's cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the idea that, like, the drug people are at war with mainstream society, it's just a horse's ass conclusion.
Yeah.
They are not at war with mainstream society. Really, really bad off drug people are more often than not at war with themselves. And it just happens that you end up getting caught in the crossfire. You know, really, really bad drug people maybe shoot up and they don't have any money. And so they rob your house.
Yeah.
That's how it becomes a victim crime and not a victimless crime. You know, they get high and they go drive it, you know, whatever. But by and large, like, the drugs themselves, I mean, the thing about drugs, the thing about alcohol is that it has never needed advertising.
Yeah.
It has never needed anyone to push.
Mm-hmm.
They, simply by being surreptitious and underground and hard to get to, they're appealing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, it's something you're not supposed to do. I mean, everybody knows how the prohibition on having sex before you're married worked out.
Yeah.
So
I can't tell you how many times somebody's come to me and said, Ben, I've got all these drugs I just can't get rid of. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
I got to get these drugs to Texarkana by nightfall.
I got to move this inventory. I'm sick of staring at it. I'm tired of it. It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
And that is something, you know, actually that I thought about. So I want to see what you thought about this, because I have a theory,
mm-hmm.
an elaborate theory, as you might have guessed. But did you think this book was monotonous?
Yes, tremendously. But, you know, it would have been pretty good if I was high.
With considerable snack breaks, yeah.
No, it's very repetitive. I couldn't tell if it was written in the fashion it was written to appear more realistic, or simply because the author was not very good at writing.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, first off, it opens with... It opens very slowly, and then once drugs are introduced, the pacing speeds up to intergalactic travel style speeds.
Yeah, well, like you pointed out, you know, like the distance of days between, like, I'm not going to do this, I'm doing it. Yeah. And there's no struggle. There's no realistic struggle that she ever documents.
It's almost like two people are writing in the diary.
Yeah.
It's so disjointed.
Well, I think that's, you know, drugs make you another person and a whore lesbian beggar who moves to California.
Wishes people good luck with their dog orgasms. But, I mean, like you pointed out, you know, the other structural flaw with it is that it pretty much ends with, you know, well, the worst drug of them all is marijuana.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you alluded to, everybody that you know, audience, America, between the ages of, let's see, 17 and 60, they've done pot.
Yeah.
They're probably doing it right now.
That's the only way they can stand to listen to this thing.
Everyone you know has smoked pot at some point. If you know somebody that you think, wow, Reverend Cumberdale would know, yeah, he did. He sure did. And over time, you know, I mean, there's still, you know, older generations that would not do such a thing. But I think you'd even be surprised by how many people in their 80s and older have probably tried it. It is a far more common thing than this book and people who would believe this book would ever acknowledge.
Yeah.
And would ever believe.
Yeah.
It just seems unlikely that somebody could smoke a joint and just not beat someone to death. I mean, how's that even possible? I don't know. They must have showed remarkable restraint.
Well, you know, the thing that started to strike me, because, like, all right, so I was reading at the same time as reading this book. I was also reading a book by Roland Barthes, a French literary theorist, where he talks about the Marquis de Sade a great deal. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that there were a lot of analogies with the Marquis de Sade's books, where this ostensibly innocent person is subjected to increasingly arcane permutations of degradation and torture. So, like, at first it's just bad thing happens, she's degraded. Then it's bad thing happens and someone does the sex. Then it's bad things happen and she's raped and she's treated sadistically, whatever that might mean. Presumably it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But just that the character stops really being a human being. And it's usually a thing that people criticize about the Marquis de Sade. You know, like his characters aren't really people. They are more or less like elements in an algebraic equation. You know, so like, well, how can you combine these libertines in such a way that it's a new sex thing?
Mm-hmm.
And Barthes' point is that it's, in the Marquis de Sade at least, it's not really monotonous. The point is not really, like, the violation of virtue or things like that. It is that, like, the language is combining and twisting and moving and all this sort of stuff. And it occurred to me that, like, the test of what an author is actually interested in is where their writing is. You know, where a man's treasure is, that is where his heart is, as the Gospels would say. And her really shitty writing is about happy times. All of her glorious, lyrical, beautiful writing, even her sharp and stunning turns of phrase, come when she's really, really degraded and fucked up. It's almost sort of like the thing about like Madame Bovary, where, you know, famously, like, Flaubert starts out the book hating Madame Bovary, like just thinking she's a piece of shit. And so he writes all these really degrading things about her. And over time, it's almost like he starts to sympathize with her. And in the last few hundred pages, like, she actually comes alive, and she seems to have, like, thoughts and ideas and all sort of stuff. And it just struck me that the author kind of shows her hand unconsciously by making the drug experiences so much more vivid, so much more linguistically interesting, mm-hmm. that she's not really interested in the good Alice.
No.
She wants an almost, like, pornographic experience with a teenage girl. She wants to watch a teenage girl be degraded and raped and violated and tortured and, you know.
That dead Mormon woman is a fucking monster.
Damn you!
Beatrice Fox! My God.
You can't libel the dead, right?
Well, we can just claim that this podcast was actually by two anonymous parties who entered the farmhouse. You know, they'll never be able to pin it on us.
Well, they beat us to death. They were high on the pots.
Yeah. Well, I think there's something to that theory. And I remember, it seems like when we were in school, we had a couple of people come and talk to us, you know, probably to fulfill some sort of community service obligation. And I always noticed that when they would talk about, you know, they'd be very, very thankful they were no longer on drugs. But whenever they would talk about drugs, they would get that certain wistful quality. Of just, yeah. Oh, man, you know, it was really great. And it was just awesome. So, and that's the problem with drugs, you know. Yeah. The problem with drugs isn't that they're really terrible. It's no. Like, no, I mean, crack is probably awesome, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to find out, but I'm sure, man, I'd have a pigeon old wang dang doodle if I got my hands on some crack. But I think we should talk about the very ending a bit more.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, she's in the mental institution. That one, actually, it had one of the funniest asterisks footnotes that I've ever seen. She's talking about a BP.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, throughout the book, you know, like, there'll be abbreviations that will be, like, DT. Mm-hmm. And then she'll, like, you know, asterisk down at the bottom, detention school.
Yeah.
Or various HEP slangs. And it'll be like, you know, this girl was a BP. Down at the bottom of the page, baby prostitute.
You seen that new show on the WB?
TLC's making a mint off the baby prostitute line.
At the end of the book, she gets out of the mental hospital or whatever it is. While she's there, she meets this girl named, what's her name, Babby? Is that her name?
Babby.
Who's basically the little match girl. Just, you know, every horrible thing that could possibly happen to someone has happened to her. Like, well, after she was raped, that meteor hit her, and then she was never the same. So, you know, she has a real bad time in the mental hospital. But then she gets out, and everything's great.
Right.
And, like, everything is just fine. And she decides that, you know, now that she's squared away, she's going to stop keeping that diary. It's a new chapter in her life. And then the epilogue. The subject of this book died 3 weeks after her decision not to keep another diary. Her parents came home from a movie and found her dead. They called the police and the hospital, but there was nothing anyone could do. Was it an accidental overdose? A premeditated overdose? No one knows, and in some ways that question isn't important. What must be of concern is that she died, and that she was only one of thousands of drug deaths that year. You'll notice I tried to summon Jack Webb as much as I could when reading that. That surprised me.
Yeah.
Number one, because it comes out of nowhere.
Absolutely, you know. Out of nowhere.
Yeah, just, you know, you have no idea what triggered the relapse. You have no idea of anything.
Yeah.
It's particularly strange since there were so many places where you reasonably could have killed her off in the book. And she waits until the very end and just, oh yeah, she died somehow.
P.S. death.
But I think it also, she gives away where her priorities are based on the fact that she basically says, Why did she die? Well, who gives a shit? But the important thing is, thousands of teenagers every... Well, right. Even you don't care about your protagonist.
Exactly, yeah. She dismisses the entire struggle of the book in a sentence.
Yeah.
You know, that the dark night of the soul this girl's been experiencing for years, literally, is essentially irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because... And yet, the whole point of the book is to show, well, you know, you're not a statistic. You're an individual. Well, it turns out you are a statistic. Yeah. You're one of thousands of drug deaths every year, and that's awful. And goddamn it, somebody ought to do something about it. That's basically the thrust. You know, it's a tarted up crime report. Not even a crime report. Those are usually pretty interesting. but yeah, that sort of blasé dismissal. Again, you know, it does seem to indicate that for this author, there was perhaps some sort of grotesque fascination with the underworld. You know, I mean, I was thinking about this when I was sort of imagining, like, all right, well, to what extent is this a tragedy? And when you read about the opening sections, when you read the opening sections that are all about, like, you know, well, I'm going out on a date, and the mayonnaise is almost dried, and you know, all this stuff. No teenager would read those sections and be like, man, this sounds like a pretty cool life. Or even a life I could relate to. Mm-hmm. It is only sections that an adult could read and go, man, this girl doesn't know how good she has it.
Yeah.
It's a book, it is a fantasy about teenagers written for other adults who are also just red-assed about the drug menace. And I mean, I think that's kind of part of the, one of the characteristic qualities, perhaps, of the, you know, the post-youth revolution of the 60s. Is that, you know, every time that parents or older people came out to say, like, well, I'd like to talk about the drug problem, immediately talked past the kids.
Yes.
Straight to other adults. Okay. Straight to other people who did not need to hear the warning. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of people had horrible crap happen to them. Mm-hmm. I've told you the story of the two people that, you know, they were a couple and they were cocaine people. And eventually they locked themselves in a room with their mutual cocaine stash. And because they did not trust each other to leave the cocaine alone, they like crapped and peed in potted plants just so that they couldn't leave the cocaine alone. So, I mean, it's some rough old stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
But
it is bad.
But you know, come on, man. Come on.
Well, and that's the essential problem with the war on drugs, is that if you discuss all drugs with this level of shrieking hysteria,
yeah,
no one's going to believe anything you have to say.
Right.
If this book ended with, you know, well, I was doing meth and I was blowing a guy, okay, well, you know, that seems somewhat reasonable. Well, I had to, if I wanted that marijuana cigarette, that jazz cigarette, I had to blow big ass. Well, no, you didn't, probably. You probably could have made it without it, you know?
Right.
It's just ridiculous, and it works counter to its purposes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so.
So would you recommend it, Greg?
I mean, I could see recommending it because it's so funny.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one reason that I would not recommend it is because it's so goddamn long in so many ways. I would, if you're looking for an analog, I would have to go back to the old Marquis de Sade. Mm-hmm. Recommend Justine. Justine is basically an innocent girl, and she basically just horrible stuff happens to her everywhere. She goes to, like, an inn. It's like, oh, there's some aristocrats here. Well, looks like they're gonna have sex with me. I mean, like, it doesn't make any sense. It's crazy. It's weird. And there are times that it is good to read something that really doesn't have any referent in reality, and it's just weird nonsense. And it's especially strange to read it, you know, knowing that it was written in the middle of the 17th, or 18th century, rather. So, but yeah, what about you?
Well, I too am tempted to recommend this book just based on how funny it is. I feel like it should be on every hipster's bookshelf.
Yeah.
Well thumbed and highlighted to haul out at parties.
Yeah.
However, I just can't do it, and instead, I will recommend a book that I think is a far, surprisingly, a far superior cautionary drug tale.
Hmm.
And for a variety of reasons, it pains me to recommend this book, but I will recommend Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by the good Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. And I do this because, as I've discussed in the past, I'm a big fan of Dr. Thompson.
Yeah.
The agony of being a fan of Thompson is seeing how many people misunderstand his work.
Yeah.
I think that Fear and Loathing, while many people take away from it a message of, you know, man, drugs are great and crazy,
yeah,
I think that book is a far superior cautionary tale than this one.
Mm.
Because I think it captures the essential horror of, oh God, I could be found out at any moment. Mm. What do these people think of me? I think it digs into that actual sense of paranoia, constantly looking over your shoulder. I think it conjures up the fear and terror of the situation and the terror of looking back on your works and being baffled by them better than this book ever could. And it is just as much a work of fiction.
Yeah.
And, I'll give that one my recommendation.
I think that's a good one. I think that's a very good one. So, what are we reading next?
I thought about this for a little bit. I got an unorthodox recommendation. We're reading a book that's actually only available as a Kindle single. So, I apologize for that, folks. It's a Kindle single called Heaven and Mel by Joe Esterhaas.
Hmm.
And apparently it is the story of how Joe Esterhaas, author of Showgirls and Burn Hollywood Burn, an Alan Smithy film, was to collaborate with Mel Gibson, noted anti-Semitic lunatic, on a film about the Maccabees. And somehow, the project just didn't come to fruition.
Weird. Well, I guess we should, as always, recommend that people follow us on the Twitter space. We got at Ben R. Williams. Follow Ben. Intermittently follow me at Old Jawbone. Make sure you visit Ben's website, benrwilliams.com.
Yeah. Shoot us an email, cannonfodderpod@gmail.com.
We love email.
Yes, yes. Please do. We're sometimes slow in replying, but we will reply. And additionally, want to thank, as always, dear friend Ryan Browning for the use of his song Destroyer, which bookends the podcast. And you should probably go to sewntogetherrecords.com and download that and other great music from the Roanoke, Virginia area.
Yeah.
Without any further ado, good night from the farmhouse.
Good night, everyone.